yes, no, yes, no, maybe? I don't know. That was my specific and policy-rich recap of the Senate's healthcare debate this week, where the fate of 17% of the U.S. economy is still uncertain. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. The thing is, though, no matter what happens on Capitol Hill, millions of us still go to the doctor, get our healthcare bills, and have a very real stake in how insurance works in our country. So while the Senate saga appears to be on pause for now, largely because a group of moderate Republicans said they can't support cuts to future Medicaid spending, the question of repealing the Affordable Care Act hasn't gone away. The shape of the U.S. healthcare system, how we get insurance, is still really up for debate. And while all of this is happening, companies, insurers, and, you know, people are trying to figure out what to do. So we asked Craig Hasday to come in and sort out a few questions for us. He's the president of Frankel Benefits, an insurance brokerage and benefits consulting company. Craig, what do health insurance markets look like in the U.S. right now?
There's a lot of different components of the markets. I mean, the vast number of people that have health coverage in the United States are covered by Medicare and Medicaid. Or by employer-provided coverage. And within that employer marketplace, there's two segments. There's the small group marketplace and the large group marketplace. And the large group marketplace is largely self-insured. So when you look at coverage, most Americans are actually through the employer covered by self-insured employers, and there are no insurance companies.
Well, what does that mean, self-insured employers?
So the insurance means someone's taking risk, someone is taking a premium and they're paying claims as they're presented. With self-insurance, the employer takes the place of the insurance company. They're taking risks. There might be stop-loss insurance, which is insurance to protect against catastrophic claims, but they're actually paying the claims and making the claims adjudication decisions.
So when you think about where we are right now, you work with a lot of companies. What do companies come to you guys and say, this is what we want for our employees?
You know, so I would say that largely employers want to provide the best benefits possible within their budgets. And the budgets vary widely by industry, by profitability of a company. But most employers are good stewards of insurance. Not all. I mean, some, you know, try to get away with as little as they can. It's actually interesting as the Affordable Care Act went into play, there was a lot of consternation amongst large employers. But really, the large employers, by and large, figured out how to navigate around the Affordable Care Act, and really not much changed. And you know, one of the interesting discussions was regarding the repeal, and I was asked what would happen if there was repeal, what would happen to the large employers, and quite frankly, very little. The large employers have largely planned around ACA. The rules would roll back to what they were. They would eliminate some fees and taxes, which they would not have to pay, but really the markets wouldn't really be disrupted for large employers and for Medicare if there was repeal. The big issue with repeal is Medicaid, and that's a wild card because so many people have come to rely upon Medicaid benefits.
Yeah, so what happens if there is just a strict repeal vote? You know, these kind of votes that we saw repeatedly in the House. What happens then?
Well, it doesn't look like that's going to happen at this point.
True.
But if there was a repeal, it would roll back to the pre-ACA rules. The biggest issues in the rollback of the Affordable Care Act are people with subsidies. And that's going to have an enormous impact. Actually, there are two. There's people with subsidies and also people on Medicaid. And I'll get into the Medicaid discussion in just a minute. But people who have subsidies who are paying very little for coverage, they're going to lose those subsidies. And all but the very sickest are just simply not going to be able to afford coverage. It's just unaffordable. And we're going to create a situation where the insurance companies are not going to be willing to play. The variable that I think is going to come into play are the states, because insurance provided by insurance companies is regulated by state law. As far as Medicaid goes, there are so many people in the country that have become so reliant upon Medicaid benefits. I just don't see that states that have expanded Medicaid are going to be able to roll it back without revolt.
And that certainly seems to be the case with the senators from those states who said absolutely not.
Very clearly. The senators in states that expanded Medicaid understand the political realities of pulling back the Medicaid expansion, and they're going to have to find a way to fund it, increase taxes, something, but I don't think there could be a full rollback of Medicaid in the states that have opted to expand.
If you could make tweaks to the ACA, what would you do?
I would definitely expand the coverage tiers, the premium tiers, from 3 to 5. I think that that's...
What does that mean?
So right now, under the Affordable Care Act, the difference in premium between the ones that pay the lowest cost and the ones that pay the highest cost is a maximum of 3 times. There's only 3 rate bands. What it allows is the difference in cost between the youngest and the oldest citizens to be a wider spread of rates. Right now, within the Affordable Care Act, we have a vast number of younger, healthier people who are opting out of the system. Part of the reason they're opting out is because they're subsidizing older Americans. If there were more rating tiers, then the older people would pay costs which are more equal to the amount of benefits that they would consume. So increasing the rating tiers, I think, is important. I would unquestionably increase substantially the individual penalty to not participate in coverage, because one of the other problems with the Affordable Care Act is people would access the system when they needed benefits and then opt out. And that free riding cost the insurance companies quite a bit.
You study this stuff very closely. Look into the future a little bit. Well, do we have any sense of what's going to happen in the next year?
I don't think the future is a year. I think we're looking at, you know, more like the 5 to 10 year time horizon. I think that we're going to be jockeying with chipping away at the Affordable Care Act. I think that even if the Republicans aren't successful in repealing or replacing the Affordable Care Act through the legislative process, the Republicans are going to be able to substantially impact things, for example, by not enforcing the individual mandate, which, by the way, is pretty weak anyway. I think, you know, for the next few years, we're just going to be stumbling through trying to keep equilibrium in the system. I'm a little worried because, you know, one of the things that all of this political posturing does is create uncertainties, and insurance companies are very nervous about uncertainties. I mean, they're concerned about where that's going to lead to, because the legislatures, federal and state, have the ability to take what's out there and mandate that insurance companies do certain things or apply political pressure to continue to offer coverage or continue to offer some types of coverage. Insurance companies are very nervous. And if you've been watching the stock prices of insurance companies,
yeah,
they've been moving quite a bit with almost every change in the Republican debate. I think the insurance companies are kind of trying to lay low because they're not exactly sure what direction the healthcare in this country is going. I think that what they're trying to do is control the controllables.
Craig Hasday is the president of Franco Benefits. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Last week, we talked about unemployment and whether the tools we have to measure the labor market do a good job. But today, let's zoom in on one part of the story, people with disabilities. Last year, the unemployment rate for the general population was 4.6%. But for people with disabilities, it was stuck around 10.5%. That's about what it was in 2015, too. And remember, the unemployment rate only counts people who are actively looking for jobs.
I don't really see the employment rate for people with a significant disability going up. It just seems to have plateaued. And unfortunately, there's a lot of disincentives for somebody with a significant disability to return to work because they lose all their benefits. So they're kind of in a catch-22.
That's Greg Thompson. He's a licensed clinical social worker and executive director of the Personal Assistance Services Council in Los Angeles. Greg became a quadriplegic 40 years ago in a water skiing accident. After his injury, he went through rehabilitation at Rancho Los Amigos. It's a center in L.A. that works with people who have sustained a serious injury or illness, people like Greg.
I was at Rancho in 1977. I went through about a 3.5-month rehabilitative process for my spinal cord injury, and Rancho basically was a lifesaver.
Afterward, Greg worked at Rancho. While there, he started a program to help people with disabilities make long-term goals, like finding jobs. People like Hector Ochoa. Hector's 33 and has a condition that makes his bones brittle. To date, he's had more than 100 fractures. After graduating from high school, Hector didn't go to college.
I was more interested in looking for a job rather than continuing with my education. And I quickly learned that finding a job was not that easy, being a person with a disability.
He graduated in 2001, but wasn't able to find a steady job for 9 years. Now, Hector's a manager at an independent living center in L.A. While he feels secure in his job, Hector says he's seen too many other people struggle to find work.
I think individuals who are qualified and have the education behind them and are still struggling to find employment, that is what baffles me.
Carlos Benavides is another disability advocate. He's 63 and is quadriplegic. Before he was paralyzed, Carlos was a graphics designer at a Fortune 500 company.
I probably won't be able to go back to that type of employment. There are so many deadlines in graphic designs that I cannot compete in that format. I'm not able to load paper. I'm not able to reach over my head. My range of motion is very limited.
According to Carlos, people with disabilities want to work, but their workday might look different than how it does for some other people.
There's two types of people in this world, like I said. One are disabled people, and the second type of people are temporarily able-bodied. Either by age, by an accident, they're going to eventually end up using some type of disability apparatus. And my job and my goal, it seems, is to make sure that by the time that person gets there, that I've already paved the road to make it easier for them so they don't have to go through all those different trials and different situations and different scenarios that we had to get to.
If you want to talk to us about unemployment or anything you hear on the show, just reach out. You can email us. We're weekend@marketplace.org or follow us on Twitter. We're @MarketplaceWKND. Because we're Marketplace, we love to do the numbers. And here on the Weekend Show, we use them to put the events of the week in context. So with that, here are producers Eliza Mills and Sarah Menendez to bring us this week's news by the numbers. Hit it, Eliza.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is 48. That's how many hours notice you have to give if you want to cancel a hotel reservation with Marriott or Hilton.
The hotel chains, which allowed cancellations within a 24-hour window, are cracking down on people they say are gaming the system by canceling reservations last minute to get fares elsewhere.
The move is getting blowback from business travelers who say they'll be punished for changing circumstances outside of their control.
529.
That's how many dollars it costs to attend Social Star Creator Camp, a 3-day residential camp for teens who want to be YouTube stars.
The Los Angeles camp focuses on monetization, branding, shooting, and editing video for, quote, rising social media creators.
This is the camp's first summer, but its founders are betting big on social media camps. Already, there are outlets in the UK and Australia. 6.
That's the number of formats you can see Christopher Nolan's new movie in.
Dunkirk, a war epic, was shot in 70mm film, and theaters are stepping up to accommodate with larger screens.
The most expensive viewing format is IMAX 70mm, which right now costs a little over $25 a ticket in Los Angeles.
If you want to save money, the film is also showing on digital projection screens.
Don't worry, you can still see Harry Styles' beautiful face.
Look, it's summer and it is hot. And I don't know about you, but I am pretty much constantly drinking water. We all need it, of course, and part of what governments do is provide us with tap water. But at the same time, the American bottled water industry made $16 billion in revenue last year. Plus, you know, there are Britas, Pure filters, supplements, all that stuff. Today, we're going to look at water from an economic perspective. Water under the ground, and what happens when two different cities and two different countries are forced to share it, and the water we pay for.
I've always wanted someone to ask me how I think about bottled water.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, I absolutely do not like bottled water.
Yes, I like it. Bottled water. It's easy. It's the transportation. It's good for health.
That water has a very distinctive, yucky taste. It's like eating lima.
Bottled water is a big deal in the U.S., love it or hate it. But when you get down to it, for every bottle of water from a crystal clear mountain spring, there's another bottle of water that is filtered municipal water, a.k.a. tap water.
So if you are supposed to filter your own tap water, you could get
a similar quality of what some bottled waters are selling.
That's Nika Leba. She is director of Healthy Living Science at the Environmental Working Group, a research and advocacy organization. In 2008, EWG researchers found that half of bottled water brands had the same chemical tracings found in filtered tap water. In other words, it's basically the same stuff. And for Leba, that means the same health concerns.
There is so much difference between the quality of municipal water across the country, but there could be a similar difference in the quality of water from bottle to bottle.
Leba doesn't think the tap water system is perfect. There are some outliers, of course. But on the whole, she says tap water in the U.S. is good. And it's pretty easy to research your local tap water quality, but it's much harder to figure out where an individual bottle of water came from. Leba is definitely a tap water fan. But that $16 billion I mentioned earlier means Americans love bottled water. And if the selling point isn't actually the water quality, then what is it? Tom Perko is the CEO of Bevmark, a food and beverage consulting company, and he has thought a lot about this question. How do you sell something that you can already get for free?
Our culture has moved beyond simple hydration, and people drink bottled water for all kinds of reasons. The first originally was safety, but we've moved way beyond that. And then the next step was convenience, and everybody is, with our lifestyles, is concerned about having something within arm's reach and you can take anywhere. But we've gone way beyond that as well. Bottled water now is just simply part of how we live.
Is that more a case, do you think, of good PR for bottled water or bad PR for tap water?
Well, I think we're past the bad PR for tap water. I mean, occasionally you have situations like Flint, but that's
right.
That's almost an aberration. But, you know, for the past, let's say, 30 years, that the real key to how America works and, more importantly, thinks is that this massive machine that we have to influence our behavior, our thoughts and our feelings, is extraordinarily powerful. You know, we watch TV, we're on the internet and social media, and we're influenced to think and feel in a certain way and be part of a community. So marketing is, in some ways, kind of the business and the religion of America. So it's primarily marketing.
You know, I'm sort of surprised by this because now we're in a moment where people are, to at least some degree, more environmentally conscious. You can buy, you know, a glass or a metal water bottle. And yet, I gather from your data that the market for, you know, those plastic bottles of water is increasing.
Consumers may say one thing or even feel one thing, but do exactly the opposite. So even though we may be concerned about climate change, we still do a lot of things that are obviously wasteful. The industry has tried to, you know, deal with that to some extent, not so much in recycling, but coming up with bottles that are much lighter PET, much lighter plastic. But again, you know, we're dealing with a cultural phenomenon. Water is not about water. You know, if you want to think about water, think about it more like air. The air you breathe and the quality of the air is a little bit like the water you take to stay alive. We're mostly water. Water is hydration, so you can be alive. And there are so many things attached to that according to who you are, how you feel about your self-esteem, how you feel about your peers. And water is kind of in that sphere. So some minor, to some people, you know, of concern about the environment, but that's minor and doesn't have any way to influence these other broader and deeper behaviors.
Well, I guess in that sense, let me expand this out. What is the value of water?
We have a new paradigm. We have shift in this culture that I've been talking about, which really determines everything in a way. We have a shift away from simply hydration, the health of water with minerals like potassium and magnesium, et cetera. I'm moving away from that and not necessarily all the way to it being a pharmaceutical thing about a medical kind of approach to water. It's not that at all. But water was lifestyle, and it still is lifestyle. But now we're looking at something that has values that hopefully allows one to stay away from this horrible epidemic of obesity. And it really is that. If you talk to any of the health profession, you know, they'll tell you that it's just something that is of great concern for all kinds of diseases going forward. So water is capitalizing upon that, but the same people who sell you carbonated soft drinks and energy drinks and fruit juices and all that are thinking more about bottled water and how that makes certain that their shareholders get the right returns.
Tom Perko, president of Bevmark, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Now, a different story about water. It's on the U.S.-Mexico border. It's been there for thousands of years, and it definitely can't be stopped by a wall. Groundwater. Specifically, an aquifer that crosses the border between New Mexico and Mexico. It's called the Mesilla Bolson on the U.S. side. It's drinkable, and it's sandwiched between two of the biggest metro areas in the Southwest. So, yeah, there's a sharing problem.
Ultimately, like they say, the river pays for all of it. That is the lifeblood of this valley. No river, no life. Period.
That was John Kleischult, a pecan farmer at this border in southern New Mexico, talking about the aquifer. Lauren Villagran is an investigative reporter at Searchlight New Mexico, and she wrote a 5-part series on the situation for the Albuquerque Journal. She says if you go there, you won't see much. Well, above ground anyway.
Obviously, it's not visible to the naked eye. It's underground. I think a lot of people, when you hear the word aquifer, you think of this big underground lake. And that's not what this is. It's sort of like water that is held between grains of sand and silt and clay. And it's sort of like a wet sandbox.
A wet sandbox that has about 65 million acres of fresh water. In New Mexico, you have Las Cruces, a large metro area, plus farms like John Kleischult's. But across the border, also drawing from the aquifer, is the second largest city in Mexico, Ciudad Juarez.
This is a massive border city that has literally doubled in size almost every decade through the 1980s, then grown by half every decade. That level of growth is incredible and is in no way matched on this side of the border, on the U.S. side.
Two big cities, one giant body of water that both need. How do you decide what to share? I mean, there got to be rules, right?
Okay, the short answer is there are no rules, at least when it comes to international use of the aquifer. So every drop of the Rio Grande is apportioned to New Mexico, to Texas, and to Mexico. Now, groundwater, there is no binational accord. So essentially, whoever sticks a straw in the deepest and drinks it up the fastest gets the water.
And I gather that the world's richest man essentially stuck a giant straw down there as well.
Yes. So Ciudad Juarez began running out of water on the main aquifer it shares with El Paso, Texas. So they looked west. And when they looked west and saw that there was this relatively prolific, untapped source on their side of the border, they decided they wanted to go in and tap it. But they didn't have the money. So they put that contract out to bid. And Mexico's richest man, Carlos Slim, who is, in fact, one of the richest men in the world. His company bid for the project. And being one of the most influential and well-funded private enterprises in Mexico, won the contract. So Grupo Carso, which is the name of the company, basically put a straw in 23 wells on this aquifer and ran a 14-mile pipeline through the desert to Ciudad Juarez. So it was like overnight, Juarez turned on a switch that turned on demand the size of the second largest city in New Mexico. So Juarez started drinking up as much as Las Cruces does.
You know, we're talking to you because cities depend on water, farms depend on water, but water is also a commodity. How valuable is this water to all of its various users?
Oh, my goodness. I don't even know how you can sort of put, obviously, there is a price on water, what it costs for a utility to deliver that water. But when you think sort of longer term, what should water cost? Users do not pay what it's really worth. The 15-year drought that southern New Mexico has been suffering. When you think about the plans for growth, NAFTA-fueled growth on the southern New Mexico border and the way that Ciudad Juarez is growing, and when you see the incredible amount of agriculture in southern New Mexico, which I think a lot of people outside of here may not know, New Mexico vies for either number one or number two each year in terms of pecan production. We fight with Georgia. And I don't know if people realize that in the desert, that many pecans are being grown.
But this water has problems, too.
Yes. So the aquifer, the size of the aquifer is immense, right? But the vast majority of the water is brackish, which means it has high levels of salt. It's not potable. There is a freshwater cap, and that is what the farmers and the cities and industry are drawing down at this point. So at some point, what scientists say out here is we're not going to run out of water, but we're going to run out of cheap, easy-to-pump fresh water. And so something has to be done. It is the most expensive water that you can produce in the world, brackish to potable. That being said, the technology exists now. It gets cheaper all the time. And theoretically, southern New Mexico could pursue that route. Right now, it's just not financially feasible is what industry developers and folks in the business community tell me right now.
We are in a moment where relations between the U.S. and Mexico are testy at best. What happens to the future of this water and of the people who depend on it sort of in our current politics?
Well, my sense from, you know, speaking with people on both sides of the border is that it's unlikely that Washington and Mexico City are going to come to the table anytime soon to discuss this issue. That being said, people who work in, you know, on both sides of the border, we have a closer relationship to each other than, for example, northern Mexicans do to Mexico City or U.S. border residents do to Washington. So I think any hope for collaboration and cooperation lies in sort of local politics and local relationships.
That was Lauren Villagran, investigative reporter at Searchlight New Mexico. You can find her amazing five-part series on the Mesilla Bolson online at the Albuquerque Journal. Her investigation was in partnership with the McGraw Center for Business Journalism and the City University of New York. This show is all about where the economy meets real life, which means a big part of what we do is all about you. So when you make the time to reach out about stories you hear on the show, well, it makes us happy. Last week, Allison Green from Ask a Manager joined us for a new regular segment about life and work, and she had this to say about what not to wear at work.
Even if your office is business casual, you can't really wear shorts in a professional environment.
Well, Allison's segment sparked quite the conversation on Facebook this week. Chris Whetstone said, quote, "Ultra-casual at work is just more of people insisting on having everything their own way. If you, for some reason, find pants and shoes so difficult to obtain and wear for 8 hours, start your own business and work from home." By way of reply, Eddie Sheffield said, "The older I get, the weirder it seems that we have these odd, uncomfortable uniforms that frankly serve no real purpose." On the matter of wearing shorts to the office, Greg White chimed in. "If the temperature high for the day is going to be above 90, we allow shorts. But we have a long-standing battle about open-toed shoes." And on the subject of footwear, flip-flops. It would honestly take me a year to read all of the comments on this, but here's a sample. Laura Soiring-Nettleton writes, "Flip-flops are good for business. The ER business. I have seen it. As a nurse, I do not recommend them being worn anywhere." And I will leave the last word with Tina Meeker on the flip-flop yes or no question. She says, "If people invest in pedicures and have nice-looking feet, it should be okay. Unfortunately, most people don't. Nobody wants to see your gnarly, unkempt feet." And she may just have a point. Flip-flops actually came up in one marketplace meeting this week. Get in touch with your work-related questions or share your thoughts on anything you hear in the show. Our email is weekend@marketplace.org. We're on Twitter, @MarketplaceWKND. And if you're looking for stories to read on the weekend or a recipe suggestion from me, subscribe to our newsletter. Just go to marketplace.org. Over in Europe, a major divorce is getting pretty messy. I am referring to Brexit and the negotiations over exactly how the UK is going to leave the EU. Round two of the talks just wrapped up, and kind of like the US Senate on healthcare, the outcome is uncertain. So we are turning to Marketplace's European Bureau Chief, Stephen Beard. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Lizzie.
All right. How did this round of negotiating go?
The chief British negotiator said it was robust and positive. But that's not how some observers have been describing this particular chapter in UK-EU relations. They've been saying it's more like this. This is a trailer from a new film out this summer called Dunkirk, which is all about one of the darkest hours in British history in 1940, when the UK scrambled to extricate its defeated army from continental Europe after it had been routed by the Nazis. Some people are saying there are parallels between that hasty retreat from Europe and Brexit.
That is quite a metaphor. I mean, it can't be that bad. And certainly diplomats like to use terms like robust when that means, oh boy, we had a lot of disagreements. But what are the big issues that are really the stumbling blocks in this round of negotiations?
In this initial phase of the negotiations, there are three. The most contentious by far is what they're calling the Brexit bill, what Britain will have to pay the EU in order to settle its obligations before it leaves. There has been talk, as you know, Lizzie, of the Brits having to pay as much as $100 billion, which provoked British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson in Parliament recently to tell the EU to go whistle.
The sums that I have seen that they propose to demand from this country seem to me to be extortionate, and I think to go whistle is an entirely appropriate expression.
That's Britain's chief diplomat, by the way. But that elicited this somewhat gloomy response from the EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier.
I'm not hearing any whistling, just the clock ticking.
So Barnier does not seem to be, shall we say, buying Boris Johnson's joke. What about that clock? How much time does Britain have to negotiate the terms of this divorce?
Officially, less than 2 years. It's scheduled to leave the EU no later than the end of March 2019. It has to more or less settle these three issues, including the Brexit bill, before this October, when the trade talks are supposed to begin. And the trade talks will have to be wrapped up within a year so that the rest of the EU can approve the deal. All the while, as the difficulties multiply, the anti-Brexit voices are getting louder in the UK. One leading politician, Sir Vince Cable, who is the new leader of the small but vehemently pro-EU Lib Dem party, thinks that in the end, Britain actually won't leave the bloc.
I'm beginning to think that, you know, Brexit may never happen. The problems are so enormous. The divisions within the two major parties are so enormous. I can see a scenario in which this doesn't happen.
I mean, Stephen, is that possible? Theresa May kept saying Brexit means Brexit. Is it possible that Brexit might mean no Brexit?
Well, Theresa May was saying that before she was humiliated in the general election and lost her parliamentary majority. So, yes, I mean, it is possible that Brexit might not happen. It's unlikely, given the momentum that has now built up and the fact that the two main political parties in this country, who between them garnered something like 85% of the vote, went to the public, went to the people, went to the polls, saying that they were in favour of Brexit. But undoubtedly, this could end up being very messy indeed.
Marketplace's European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard. As always, Stephen, it's a pleasure.
My pleasure too, Lizzie.
Here's a question. Are you more Dolly Parton? Or Jay-Z? Turns out 44 million Americans are all about the hustle. Well, okay, the side hustle. You know, what you do after the 9-to-5 to raise a little extra cash. That data comes from Bankrate.com. And just who are the most prolific side hustlers? Here's Bankrate Sarah Berger.
And the age group actually most likely to have a side hustle are younger millennials. 28% of people between the ages of 18 and 26 have a side hustle. So that was definitely notable.
Okay, so who makes the most money? Sarah Berger says that's all about the boomers.
Younger baby boomers between the ages of 53 and 62 are the most likely age group to pull in at least an extra $1,000 per month. So not as many baby boomers are working side hustles as younger millennials, but the ones that are working them are making typically more money from them.
And just how much are people making from side hustles?
86% of side hustlers do it at least monthly, and 36% of those earn more than an additional $500 per month.
People do all sorts of things with their side hustle money, like Nick Brinks from Iowa.
I paid off my student loans super early, and now all of that money is basically going into my investments.
For others, it's about getting back on track, like Blair Logan and his wife Emily from Watkinsville, Georgia.
For us, we see these side hustles as a means to make up some ground that we feel we lost during the recession. Essentially, we're directing 100% of what we make in our side hustles toward retirement savings and college savings for our son.
Or perhaps you want to have a little fun, like David Conlin from Culver City, California.
When the opportunity to own a professional sports team came up and I didn't have to be a billionaire to buy in, I couldn't pass it up.
And if you're wondering, David is the proud co-owner of the Los Angeles Aviators, a professional Ultimate Frisbee team. For more on what it takes to make a success of your side hustle, we turn to Nick Loper. He runs the website Side Hustle Nation and hosts the Side Hustle Show podcast. So, how did Nick get his start?
My original side hustle was a footwear comparison shopping site called shoesniper.com. Actually, in its very early days, it was called shoesrus.net. I really wish I spent more than like 5 minutes searching for a domain name. But it would aggregate the catalogs from Zappos and Amazon, like all these other online footwear retailers, and spit back out where you could find the best price, and then would earn a commission on sales that came through the site.
Why did you do that? Like, what were you getting out of it that you weren't getting from your regular job?
Well, getting extra cash for one, but getting a more productive way to spend my nights and weekends rather than just watching TV or playing video games was part of it. And then even though the dollars were really small at the beginning, it was, I don't know, it was cool to build something and be like, well, this is my project. This is my thing that I'm working on. And, you know, that tiny, you know, glimmer of hope that it might someday replace the day job and become my way out.
Now you've got this podcast and you have this site where people talk about their side hustles. What makes for a good one?
What makes for a good one? One that you stick with, I think, is probably the main criteria here. And if there isn't a powerful, you know, why am I doing this? Afterwards, it's so much easier to just go back to Netflix or go back to the couch.
What are some of the most common mistakes people make?
In terms of mistakes, the ones that I see are spending too much time on the ramp-up period in terms of investing way too much time, way too much money before you've ever validated your idea, before you've ever gone out and got a customer. I mean, I'll hear from people, I spent $30,000 on this website and there's no traffic. Or I spent, you know, the last 8 months writing this book and nobody's buying it. And so it's like, will you slow down? You know, there's ways to validate this stuff before putting in all of that time.
So how do you do that? How do you make those baby steps to get a sense of whether something's really going to take off?
So the first step would be to go and ask somebody. And even that could be as simple as posting in a Facebook group or posting on your own Facebook page would be kind of the most passive way to do that, because it's like it can be intimidating to go ask somebody, you know, one-on-one, hey, would you pay me money for this? Would you buy this from me? An example, even from my own house, so my wife's a mechanical engineer by day, but by nights and weekends, she does wedding photography with a partner of hers. And so they actually got their first customers through a Craigslist ad. And me being the marketing major, I was like, who is looking for photographers on Craigslist? That sounds like a dumb idea. And within a week, they had like booked up, you know, half a dozen different gigs. And I was like, all right, I'm good on you guys. So it was kind of putting themselves out there to see if anybody would want what they had to sell. And they've gone on to, I think, probably 20x their prices since then. So it's kind of been exciting to watch their business grow.
What advice do you wish you had been given when you were starting out doing this?
A couple things would have been really helpful. The first is some sort of accountability group or peer group, because even though the numbers say, hey, look, there's 44 million other side hustlers out there doing or trying to do the same thing, it can be a lonely road. And the other thing that's kind of been a game changer this year is, you know, making sure to do one proactive thing on the business every day before diving into email, before diving into social media.
Before I let you go, what's a side hustle you thought, that is insane and that's never going to work, that totally surprised you and worked?
I met a woman, this is actually coming out on the podcast next week. She makes $4,000 or $5,000 a month teaching people how to bake the perfect sourdough bread on a platform called Udemy.com. It's an online like a peer-to-peer online education platform. I thought that was nuts because this platform is very centered toward, you know, learning how to code in the, you know, next iOS development language, whatever it is, like very tech and marketing heavy. But she's like, oh, I put up this course, and she's built this huge Facebook community of 35,000 other bakers that just love and adore her. And I was like really surprised by that story, and people were paying good money how to make the best sourdough. So I was like, pretty inspired by that.
That was Nick Loper, host of the Side Hustle Show podcast. There was some big news for sci-fi fans this past week, especially if you're fans of this show. That is, of course, the theme from Doctor Who, the long-running British TV show. Jodie Whittaker will now be the first woman to play the Doctor. Yes, a female Doctor is just one data point, but we're also seeing more diversity across the sci-fi and fantasy landscape, like Ava DuVernay's A Wrinkle in Time, Marvel's Black Panther. Sci-fi and fantasy have often been dominated by white men, so is this a real shift in the business of science fiction? Tanana Reeve-Dhu is a sci-fi novelist and writing teacher at Antioch University. We called her up to ask her that question.
I really do think it's a shift in the business. It won't be a straight line. There will still be movies that miscast and make mistakes and end up as hashtags that people boycott. But I think for the most part, there's a real growing awareness of groups who have been traditionally sidelined in books and film, you know, and that's changing.
Where is that coming from? Is it a bottom-up thing, you know, from fans, from people who go to conventions? Is it top-down from studios or publishing houses that realize they've ignored a section of the market?
My sense is definitely that it's bottom-up. There's some top-down, maybe in TV, where Nielsen ratings show that Black and Latino households are watching more TV. But what's happening, I think, is mostly bottom up, that we have the advent of social media, which cannot be overstated, you know, so it's no longer just a private conversation with you and your friends. It can become a national movement. And there's a lot of leadership emerging as well among artists like Ava DuVernay, you know, who is very much a leader in everything from women getting roles, women directing, and that incredible inclusivity she has in what I saw in the teaser trailer for A Wrinkle in Time.
Take me back to when you were starting out as a writer, because you have a tremendous body of work now, but what was it like trying to break through?
Well, I was very, very lucky that I started sending out my work in the wake of Terry McMillan, where the publishing world woke up and said, oh, Black people read. So I would have probably had a tougher time breaking in to, say, speculative fiction, say, science fiction, fantasy, and horror of that era. But because Black writers were so hot during that time, commercial houses were publishing my work, which, you know, a lot of those were horror novels. So it was great.
When I was growing up, it felt like that was sold to white boys and that was the audience. How do we think we've seen the market shift, or has it?
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about books, for example, which has become very female driven in terms of the readers, or movies, where I still think there is that demographic, that target demographic. But also when you have a Jordan Peele come out with a movie like Get Out that blows away the box office, that really helps other creators get a little ammunition in the meeting, you know, because before you're trying to pitch it based on, oh, I remember a long time ago that one movie, whereas Get Out is a really fresh example and it made money. And that's what obviously executives care about. So, yeah, publishers are going to more readily look at your work as something that will potentially make them money.
You also teach writers. What do you tell them about trying to get their ideas, you know, seen, read, heard?
Well, it's great to get your name out there. Social media is very helpful in terms of finding audience and building rapport with audience. But, you know, one of the things that even in these great times, I would say of bounty and plenty, I tell all my writing students not to necessarily count on writing for a living. It's that uneasy relationship between art and commerce. And if you have a job that pays your bills and your free time can be all about your art on no one else's schedule, where you don't have to bend it this way or that because, you know, you think maybe it'll be more marketable that way, write your truth. And I really think in a lot of ways that's what brings writers the greatest success.
Tananarive Due, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Sean McHenry. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer. Jake Gorski is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. And Deborah Clark is our vice president and general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.